There are things that I'm preaching on today that I never dreamed years ago that I would address in a sermon. Yet, if you've listened to the news at all over the past few months, you've likely been hearing many stories relating to gender type issues. Many stories on transgenderism or gender confusion or gender changes. And so this is something not that is a massive problem in our society. It's not something where millions of Americans are seeking to make a change. However, it is something that's presented to us for which we need to find a Bible answer. And no matter how recent some event may be, though we may classify it as a current event, we can understand that the answers in principle can be found within the pages of the Word of God. So what are some of the things that we're dealing with? Depending on what site you look at, sometimes you'll find that there can be as many as 15 or 20 different gender choices that you could choose in filling out a form. Some states are even talking about the idea of leaving gender absent on the birth certificate and allowing someone to fill that in later in life when that has been chosen. And even this week, before the state of Alabama, legislation is being discussed that would prohibit allowing children to be given any kind of hormone-blocking agents to prevent their particular birth gender coming in. So how do we deal with those issues? How do we answer our friends and our neighbors when we're presented with questions about this? One of the greatest dangers in this type of discussion is that oftentimes, because Christians do not choose to go along with the standard that society is accepting, we can be viewed as uncaring, unloving, and not compassionate. And that is just simply not the case. What I'd like for us to do in our study this morning is to talk about some principles that are certainly not new, and to also talk about how we, as the people of God, do deal with this current event from a biblical perspective. With all of these things said, let's go back to Genesis chapter 1. As we look back to the beginning of the Bible, we find in the first two chapters a detailing of the creation. And what we're going to find is that how God brought everything into existence. One of the key features of this is God's description of the creation of man and woman. And I'd like for us to look at this, first of all, from the standpoint of Genesis chapter 1. Here the writer says, "Then God said, 'Let us make man in our image, after our likeness, and let them have dominion over the fish of the sea and the birds of the heavens, and over the livestock, and over all the earth, and every creeping thing that creeps on the earth.'" So God created man in His own image. In the image of God, He created him. Male and female, He created them. That's a passage that probably most of us are very familiar with. However, there are a couple of things we need to note. First of all, when the word man is being used here, this is referring to humankind. It's not talking about a man in the opposite of a man and woman, but rather it's talking about male and female, everyone together. And as this is translated into English, our pronouns help us to understand that. When God says, "Let us make man in our image, in our likeness, and let them have dominion." So again, God, in using this term, is using it for the completeness of both male and female. Now, when we understand that, it's interesting then to look at what comes next. Because after God describes the creation of mankind or humankind, He follows that with the work that He's given humankind to do. So in verse 28, this is what we find. Again, the plural being used. "And God blessed them, and God said to them," and here He gives the threefold work of humankind. He says, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heaven and over every living thing that moves on the earth." Here we find that God is saying humans, male and female, collectively speaking as both here, your work is to fill the earth, your work is to subdue the earth, and your work is to have dominion over the earth. When we look at this in Genesis chapter 1, God gives us somewhat of a matter-of-fact accounting of the creation of humanity. However, when we move over to chapter 2, the Lord kind of slows things down a bit, and He brings the creation of humans into a much greater focus. And so, as we look at Genesis chapter 2, much of the rest of the creation process is summarized, it's put in very small detail, and it's at that point then God begins to talk more fully about the creation of humankind. Here's what we find in chapter 1, verse 28 that we just read. And God blessed them and said to them, "Be fruitful and multiply and fill the earth and subdue it and have dominion over the fish of the sea and over the birds of the heavens and over every living thing that moves on the earth." So again, here in chapter 1, we're finding very matter-of-fact, very scaled-down details. And so if this was the only thing that we had to go by, the question might be, how is this to be carried out? God has said to them, to humankind, populate the earth, subdue the earth, have dominion over the earth. But the question is, how is this going to be done? Genesis chapter 2 is going to answer that question due to its significant more detail. And so as we look in chapter 2, verse 18, we find God saying this, "It is not good that man shall be alone. I will make a helper fit for him." Everything else we've read about the creation so far has been classified as either good or very good. Here, however, God says, "It is not good that man should be alone." So what does He do? Well, if we look on down to verse 23, "Then the man said," this is after the creation of Eve, "Then the man said, 'This flesh at last shall be called woman, because she was taken out of man. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh.'" This, interestingly, falls right in line with the rest of the creation accounts. If you were able to listen to last week's sermon, we spent a lot of time talking about the separation in the first 3 days of creation and then the population in days 4, 5, and 6. And so if we keep that separation idea in mind here, this is exactly what we find. So let's go back now to what the man says when he says, "This at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." Well, if we fill in the details there, we know that God, in creating Eve, took a rib out of Adam. There was a separation. And from that rib, from that separation, He populated with this woman, with the counterpart for man. And so Adam, as he sees Eve, he says, "This is fantastic. She's like me. She's bone of my bone. She's flesh of my flesh." And you'll recall earlier, we find in Genesis 2, where God brings the whole parade of animals in front of Adam to let him realize none of these are suitable companions. But the real irony of this is, while the woman was separated and a distinct individual was made, God here includes His plans for marriage. Right here in the beginning of time, when He says, "Therefore a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh." They're in unison. They're working together. Now let's go back to our question. How is it that God is going to use humankind to populate the earth, to subdue the earth, to have dominion? Here He says the answer to that question is that man and woman are going to work in unison. They are going to populate through procreation and through the work that I have given them to do in unison. They'll bring that dominion over the earth. They'll bring that subduing. We might think it strange for Adam and Eve, who had no parents, to have this verse applied to them. But this verse is not really applying to Adam and Eve. This verse is for our learning. God is saying to the reader, as I describe to you my original plans for man and woman in the creation work that I gave them to do, I want you to understand that this is the beginning of marriage. And from here on out, this is how marriage is to take place. We think about that being found in the book of Genesis, very early in the Bible story. However, the principle does not go away. In fact, when we come to the New Testament, to Matthew chapter 19, we have the Lord Jesus Himself talking about marriage. And what does He do? Well, let's look at what He says in verses 4 and 5. He answered, "Have you not read that He who created them from the beginning made them male and female and said, 'Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh.'" So here, as Jesus walked the earth and questions about marriage are brought to Him, how does Jesus answer? He answers by the standard that was given in the book of Genesis, the standard that is to apply to humankind until humankind's existence as we know it on this earth comes to a close. God tells us in Genesis what's to happen. The Lord Himself tells us in Matthew what this is to be like. And so what we are finding is that God created two distinct genders, male and female, who are to work in unison through marriage to carry out the principles that He's given to mankind from the very beginning. Let's look at one more passage that affirms this point. As the Apostle Paul is writing to the Ephesians, he's going to tell them all about what marriage is supposed to be. So as we consider that and how he's going to tell men and women to behave themselves in marriage, let's put all of this together. So before we read his words, but yet with the Genesis information in mind, let's make a couple of observations. Here we find that God's plan created an environment where life flourishes. And I'll say this, I think that explains to us all of the regulations that God puts on of things concerning fornication and adultery and homosexuality and all of these different sexual sins. What He's saying is, I want the perfect environment where life can come in and new humans can come into being who are going to be raised in my glory and my honor so that they can populate the earth with people who are in my image. God says, my plan is for mankind to flourish. And this is the environment where I want that to happen. And once again, as we're moving into this passage that the Apostle Paul is going to give us, we need to understand that both man and woman are essential in this plan. It cannot be done alone. Okay, with that preface in mind, let's take a look here in Ephesians chapter 5, verses 21 down through 33, a rather long reading. But yet, it helps us to make the point that God is seeing marriage as a permanent kind of relationship involving a man and a woman, a male and a female in their genders. And Paul is explaining how they are to treat one another. So let's take a look at this. If we back all the way up to verse 21, the last section of the letter ends by saying, "Submit to one another out of reverence for Christ." In other words, as servants of God, we are to put ourselves in a place where others are being served before we satisfy our own wants and needs. That's good to remember in approaching this passage. So the apostle then says, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord. For the husband is the head of the wife, even as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now, as the church submits to Christ, so also wives submit in everything to their husbands. Let's stop there for just a minute. This passage is not so much about marriage as it is about our relationship to Christ. And so Paul is saying, to help you understand how you relate to Christ, let's think about this in terms of how a wife relates to her husband. This passage is very controversial in modern times. The idea of submission, so misunderstood, is looked upon more as bondage or servitude, and that is absolutely not what the apostle is saying, any more than he's saying we're in bondage to Christ, that somehow Christ is going to treat us as some kind of slave, as some kind of being that we don't care about, and that is so far from the truth. But yet the point is, in this relationship, a wife is going to defer to her husband. The husband is the head of the house. The husband, in his role as the man in this relationship, is given headship in the family, and the wife is to respect that, as we'll see here in a little while. But husbands are also given a lot of responsibility in this. Let's pick up here and see what he says. With husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish. Let's note for a second time. In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own body. He who loves his wife loves himself. For no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we are members of His body. And then, what do we have? Once again, we have got the Genesis standard put in this discussion. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. And then the apostle finishes the discussion by saying, the mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. However, for a third time, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband. Wives, submit, submit, respect. Husbands, love, love, love. What we're talking about here is the work that God established at the dawn of creation, and the apostle is taking us right back to Genesis when he says, let me remind you what God said there at that first marriage. You have a place in the role of creation. You are to populate, you are to subdue, you are to have dominion over the earth, and that is going to take place with a male and a female respecting the plan of God. So then, we put all of this together, and we have a picture here that God, before we are ever born into this world, has determined our gender. And when we are born into this world, we are to accept the role that God has given us, and we are to accept the equality of the other gender. There's only two, male and female. Each are to accept the quality of the other. Each are to love the good things about the other. And each are to work in unison to carry out the plan that God has put into effect. So with all of that said, I think we need to understand then that we don't mess with the plan. When God has said, this is how I want it to be, that's what we need to respect. However, we have found from Genesis 3 forward that humans have real problems with that. And when it comes to the idea of accepting our gender as given by God, of pursuing what He expects of us as a member of that gender, we have problems at times. So what I'd like to do is to focus on a couple of the commands that God gave to understand how He in very serious terms is saying, don't try to change what I established at the very beginning. Let's go to a passage that we find in the book of Deuteronomy. This is, of course, the law of Moses being given here. And this is what we read. A woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man. Neither shall a man put on a woman's garments, for whosoever doeth these things is an abomination unto Jehovah thy God. Before we enter into any discussion of the principle within this verse, I want us to focus on a particular word, and that's the word abomination. This is one of those words that when we come across it in the Old Testament, we need to pay particular attention. Because what God is saying is, this is something that I consider so repugnant, so disgusting, that I hate it. And that word, therefore, is being used to grab our attention and to say, sit up and pay attention to what God is saying here. So then, when God says, a woman shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, and neither shall a man put on a woman's garments, what God is saying here is to violate that principle is disgusting in my sight. So let's talk a little bit about what this law is meaning. First of all, we need to pay attention to the word man. I'm always hesitant to try to make points about the original language. However, sometimes when we dig in and we look at what the word meant in the Hebrew or Greek as it was given, it does give us a little bit of insight that maybe is not quite as apparent in our English translations. And I think that's true of the word man here, and here's why I say that. The word man is used a number of times in the book of Deuteronomy. But this particular word that's translated into English is only used twice in Deuteronomy, and that's the two times that you can see on the screen. A man shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a woman, rather, shall not wear that which pertaineth unto a man, neither shall a man put on a woman's garment. The idea of this word is more than the simple designation of male. This is the idea of a distinctly manly quality. So it would be perhaps equivalent in English when we say, he is a real man. And the idea is there is no doubting that he's male, but it goes beyond that. He's showing certain qualities, certain characteristics that we are associating with manhood. That's what the apostle, or rather what Moses here is discussing. He's saying, you are not to put on anything that looks manly. That's the command that he gives to women. And the man then is forbidden from wearing any kind of women's garment. Now let's make another point here. The translation that I have used here is the American Standard Version. If you notice the American Standard as well as the King James and New King James, they give a distinction in this verse that's not found in many of the other translations. A lot of translations just simply say, a woman shall not wear a man's clothing. Well, that is true, but it doesn't go quite far enough. This translation gets the idea that she is not to wear anything that pertains to a man. So, it's not only clothing, but anything denoting a strictly masculine quality. So we might think about in the age in which this was written. She's not to go around with a sword on her side or some kind of tool that was distinctly used by a man. She is in no way to try to imitate what a man looks like. The man, in turn, is to wear no kind of garment where someone might look at him and say, I don't know if that's a man or a woman, or why is that man wearing a woman's garment? There is a distinction. So our question then is, why is that? Why do we find this law being given to the people of Israel? Well, one possibility is it's associated with idolatry. The Ashtaroth that we come across a few times in the Bible, and which will later, if I understand correctly, be adopted through the different cultures and become the goddess Venus, was associated with androgyny. And so sometimes male worshipers would wear half the garments belonging to a man and half the garments belonging to a woman to try to give the idea that they have risen above the prison of the body. And that idea, of course, is going to be turned into Gnosticism later on. That may have been a possibility. But let's talk about for certains. For certain, we know that this is a disrespect for God's plan for separating the genders. God said, I created distinctly male and distinctly female, and I don't want anybody muddying the waters. I don't want anybody trying to deconstruct what I have separated and constructed. But let's make the observation that this command is found in the law of Moses. And for people of the 21st century, this is not our law. We are not Israelites living on the other side of the cross. So then, what we would say in this passage is that we have a general principle that we can learn from. We are seeing here God telling His people, I don't want you trying in any way to bring back together what I've separated. So our question is, does this same principle carry over in the New Testament? And the answer to that is yes. When we come to Genesis chapter 11, we're going to find a principle put into place here that's very similar to what we find back in the book of Deuteronomy. However, this time, it's dealing with hair. So, the apostle writes to the Corinthians and he says, does not nature itself teach you that if a man wears long hair, it is a disgrace for him? But if a woman has long hair, it is her glory, for her hair is given to her for a covering. Now, if you read the surrounding verses and the context, it becomes very clear that the apostle is discussing gender roles. So the apostle is saying a man who's wearing his hair long and looks like a woman is not right in the eyes of God. And a woman who's cutting her hair to look like that of a man is not right in the eyes of God. Now, God's not necessarily giving particular lengths here, but rather He's saying, if you look at someone and you can't tell if that's a man or a woman, there's a problem there. There is a bringing back together what God has made very distinct. And so the principle that we find in Deuteronomy is brought forward into the New Testament where the apostle is making that same command concerning the distinction of the genders. So you put all this together and it's no deconstructing what God has constructed. Put all together, God is saying, I do not want manly women, nor do I want womanly men. I want them to understand what I have created, how I have created, why I have created, and not only to be obedient to that, but to appreciate it. That's what we find regarding this. So then, as we think about these principles that God has put into place, let's bring this all back up to our current events. So here we are. In the midst of a time when there are a lot of questions and issues being raised over what we've just dealt with in this lesson. So as a Christian living in this culture that's grappling with all of these questions, how do I deal with that? Well, the first thing I would say to us is this, that we don't cave to pressure. I mentioned in the outset of the lesson that these gender questions are not affecting massive numbers in the population. This is not something where we're seeing large numbers of people who are in this situation of trying to decide about their gender. That's not it. But we are in a situation where our society expects us to not only accept, but to appreciate the idea of gender confusion. We are expected to accept the fact that if a boy wants to become a girl, or a girl wants to become a boy, or if someone says, I'm just going to remain gender neutral, that we not only accept that, but that we appreciate it. How then are we seeing that coming about? There are so many examples. Even in our House of Representatives, discussions have been held to remove any kind of gender language from bills that come before the U.S. Congress. To not make any designations of male or female or mother or father or brother or sister, but to put everything in neutral language. We've even had directives from our government that says if a boy believes he's a girl, a school is obligated to treat him as a girl, to let him use the dressing room that's appropriate to the gender that he thinks he is or she thinks that she is. We're seeing these kinds of things coming, and even in the presidential debates of a few months ago, they began with the candidates identifying themselves and then giving their pronouns of choice. That's the culture that we're now living in. And the problem that we find is not that a great number of Christians are going to somehow start questioning gender. That's not it. The problem we're going to see is that this will, and probably already is, a major test in the workplace and in schools. Christians who are working in corporations that are seeking to maintain a good status with society will be expected to conform to these beliefs. And if schools are used as somewhat of these sociological laboratories for gender experiments, our children will be dealing with that also. And what that does not mean is that we suddenly pull ourselves out of society and we don't work in these places or we keep our kids out of school. That's not it. God has never said, try to separate yourself out from the world in that regard. But what it does mean for us is that we need to make sure that we are not allowing ourselves to fall prey to false reasoning. We must stay true to God's plan. I'm reminded of what the Apostle Paul told the Romans as he was about to discuss the sin of homosexuality and all of the problems associated with that and idolatry. And for a number of things, he says, for although they knew God, they did not honor Him as God or give thanks to Him. But they became futile in their thinking, and their foolish hearts were darkened. Claiming to be wise, they became fools. One of the problems that we're going to see is that a refusal to accept this is going to be cast as an unloving response. And it's already being presented that those who are wise, that those who really have all the understanding they need, are willing to accept these things. But the apostle says that's exactly the opposite. He says those who abandon the plan of God are the ones who have abandoned wisdom, who have become foolish. And as these things began to pressure around us, as we began to be faced with an acceptance in our workplace or an acceptance in our school, it means that as the people of God, we must stay true to that principle that God laid down at the very beginning of time, that there are two genders, male and female, and that we are not going to cave to any kind of pressure to conform to any other standard. So as the people of God then, we understand that. However, as the people of God, we must also understand that truth has always got to be spoken in love. When we think about dealing with this kind of issue, there is a certain reaction to it. And sometimes that reaction is going to put us in the stereotypical view of Christians, that we are angry, that we are scared, that we are stuck in the past, none of those things being true. But yet we must be careful that when we are dealing with this kind of thing, that we are always looking at it from the standpoint of not doing it simply to condemn others, but rather to help people find the truth. We don't always know what causes this gender confusion. Sometimes we want to say, well, it's upbringing, and sometimes it is, but that's not always the case. We are not called on to diagnose the problem. The problem has presented itself. However, when we are dealing with this, we need to understand that those who are struggling with these gender identity questions need the grace of God just as much as you and I do. This is not the time when we are going to stand in judgment over someone, that we are going to be condemning of someone, because it may very well be that this is a person who is so confused that they've convinced themselves that this is just simply the way that they are. That is someone in need of the grace of God, just as every other sinner. So then, when we consider these things, we need to understand that if a situation arises where I can help someone who is having this kind of issue, I take that challenge. We need never be a people who stand back in fear of saying, oh, if I help with this, I may get canceled. If I help with this, I may lose my job. We are going to speak the truth. We are not going to cave to the world standard. But nonetheless, in love, we are going to help a fellow human being who is struggling with a problem find his or her way to God. In these situations, I like to think about what Jude told us when he says, save others by snatching them out of the fire to others, show mercy with fear, hating even the garment stained by the flesh. These kinds of things we don't like because they violate the standard of God. However, we are going to do everything within our possibility to show that mercy of God if we are truly people of God. We are going to show the love that Jesus showed. How would Jesus have handled these situations? He would have taught the truth, but He would have taught it in such a way that someone could see that God does love them and that God's grace is there to help. Let me add just one more thing for us to consider. We need to understand that now more than ever, we need to be teaching about gender. And that is to our own children. That is to the young people who we have in our Bible classes. We need to teach appreciation for one's own gender, appreciation for the opposite gender, and the appreciation of that separation that God has made. But let me put this challenge in. Let's make sure that when we are teaching gender and not stereotype. There are some young men and older men who are very quiet by nature. They're not going to be terribly aggressive, perhaps not even interested in sports. Conversely, there are going to be some young women who are very outgoing and very athletic, and both of those situations are fine. To teach that a boy has got to have a ball in his hand and the loudest one in the room is not gender. To teach a girl that she must sit back and never say a word and never show any life is not to teach gender. That's to teach stereotype. What we must do is to understand how God has defined these terms. And when we have that appreciation, what we do then is we teach boys how to be men. What does that involve? One of the key things is leadership. We see that God, both in the home and the church, has placed men in leadership roles, and men must learn how to lead. Why do we think the apostle three times over said, husbands, love your wives? Because that's one of the hardest things for men to do. Boys need to be taught how to be leaders. They need to be taught how to work, how to provide for a family, how to be faithful men in a congregation, how to preach, how to be elders. They need to follow the standard that God set at the very beginning, and we need to be helping with that. Boys need to be taught how to be men. Women need to be taught as well, beginning just like in our earlier illustration, very young, where girls are trained to be women. Women also have leadership roles, different than a man. God has given different responsibilities, but there is a distinct leadership role that a woman is to have, and that comes out expressly as God is talking about her role in the home. As Paul was writing to Timothy about young widows, he told Timothy, he said, "You tell young widows to get married and to learn how to run a household." What's really interesting is the word that's used there is the same word that we use for despot. In other words, she is to be the mover and the shaker in the household. And by all means, we never need to teach girls that that's some kind of inferior position. That if she is looking at her life's work of being that woman who is taking leadership in the household to keep things going, that that's somehow inferior. We are teaching against the plan of God. We need to teach young girls how not only to run a household, but also their very strong role within local churches. Their role of building up and lifting up and admonishing and certain groups that they're teaching and the help that they're giving to others, maybe in a much quieter way, but just as distinctly important. That's what we need to be doing. This is not a time when we sit around wringing our hands over the status of our nation. That's not it. This is a time when we look at the problem and we tackle it with the people who we can help. And might I also add with this, that we never need to be embarrassed or apologetic about biblical standards. I am the first to agree that in the past, both genders have really messed up. For much of the world's history, men have treated women as property, treated them in exact ways that God condemned. In the past couple of decades, we have seen women who have treated men in a very inappropriate way by looking down on them. There have been problems and plenty of blame on both sides. That does not negate the plan of God. We look at what God has said to do, and we carry out that plan that He has been teaching us from page one of the Bible. Are these things pleasant to deal with? They certainly are not. Are they necessary? They certainly are. And the things that I have spoken in this lesson may, sooner rather than later, be something that would bring me to get into trouble. But whatever the case might be, we never forfeit the plan. We never give up on what God has told us is right. And when we find those who are struggling with these things, by all means, we take the opportunity to help. But as I close out this discussion, let me remind you of a passage in which the Apostle Paul wrote, "There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither bond nor free. There is neither male nor female. For ye are all one in Christ Jesus." That's not getting rid of the distinctions of male and female. It's saying that when we come to Jesus, everybody's on equal footing. A man is no better than a woman. A woman is no better than a man. Neither has the right to look down on the other because both are equally children of God. And even though our times may be turning quickly away from any kind of morality, that promise remains as true now as it did 2,000 years ago. And so if you're thinking along the lines of becoming a Christian, I want you to think about this verse, that God wants you as a part of His family. And it doesn't matter what you've done before. It doesn't matter the sins you've been involved in, because like everyone else, you have sinned and fallen short of the glory of God. But also like everyone else, you're given the opportunity to come back to Him. If I can help you with that, you let me know. If you're ready to be baptized into Christ for the remission of your sins, we can make that happen. Whatever the case, let's make sure that we're staying true to the entire plan of God and to become His children, looking forward to that day when we will live in a place where His standard will always be supreme. Thank you so much for joining in with this study today.